dressed in a coat of mail and was puffing visibly from hauling himself and the armour up the ladder. Tavi watched Navaris, willing all expression from his face as well. He was glad she'd come up so far away. It gave him time to get control of the sudden trembling in his hands before she could come close enough to see it. He took slow, steady breaths.
"She's human," Araris said quietly. "She's imperfect. She can be beaten."
"Can she?" Tavi asked.
"She's won a lot of duels," Araris said. "But most of them were the same duel, just with a different face. Someone relatively inexperienced, who let fear rule their thoughts and actions. They were over in seconds."
"I'm relatively inexperienced compared to Navaris," Tavi said dryly. "For that matter, so are you."
Araris smiled. "Patience. Don't let the fear drive you. Don't initiate. Mind your footwork, keep your blades in tight, and wait for your opening."
"Suppose she doesn't give me an opening. Outthink her. Make one."
Tavi laid a hand on the Merlin beside him.
"Like you did at Second Calderon."
"Exactly.
Very few people understand that swords aren't dangerous, Tavi, nor hands, nor arms, nor furies. Minds are dangerous. Wills are dangerous. You are heavily armed with both."
Tavi frowned at that, staring at his opponent, mulling the thought in his head. His hands stopped shaking. The ladder behind them rattled, and Captain Nalus heaved himself onto the wall. He had a fresh bandage on his cheek, where a sickle had laid open his face all the way down to his skull. Tavi had heard he'd ordered them to stitch it closed with thread rather than
wasting a healer's energies on a minor injury when other men's lives were in jeopardy.
"Your Highness," Nalus said, nodding at Tavi. "You ready?"
Tavi accepted his weapons from Araris and slung the belts over one shoulder.
"I am."
"Follow me," Nalus said.
Tavi followed the captain, who had agreed to officiate under protest, down the length of the wall toward Navaris. At the same time, the cutter began walking toward them, slim and deadly. In the ruins below, people had gathered. Legionaries, domestics, camp followers. Thousands of them. Several had climbed atop walls and dilapidated rooftops to get a better view of the top of the wall. He could only just see them in the darkness, but atop one of the nearest buildings he could make out white hair and Marat manes drifting on the gentle breeze. Kitai and her people. He nodded to them, and fists thumped simultaneously against leather-armored chests in response, the sound loud in the otherwise silent night. They reached the middle of the wall in time with Navaris. Tavi stopped far enough away from her to have time to avoid a sudden draw and lunge, while Captain Nalus stopped halfway between them.
"Phrygia, Navaris," he said. "Are you ready?"
Her flat eyes never left Tavi's.
"I am."
"Gaius Octavian," Nalus said. "Are you ready?"
"I am."
Nalus glanced back and forth between them.
"I remind you that this duel is to the death. I ask you both if you will concede the point of the duel and spare needless bloodshed."
"I will not,"
Tavi said. Navaris only smiled a little and said nothing. Nalus sighed.
"Gaius Octavian, draw steel."
Tavi did so and offered the hilts of the weapons to Nalus. The captain inspected them both for poison and handed them back to Tavi, then slung the empty weapon belts over one shoulder.
"Phrygia, Navaris, draw steel."
He went through the same process with Navaris and took her weapon belts as well.
"Very well," he said. "Neither party may move until I have stepped from between you and counted to 10. Once that is done, both participants are free to act. Do you understand?"
Both replied in the affirmative. Nalus stepped out from between them and hurried down the wall to descend to the ground. It took approximately forever, and Tavi held his gaze against Navaris's for the entire while.
"One,"
called Nalus.
"Are you nervous, boy?" Navaris asked quietly.
"A little sleepy," Tavi replied. "A bit hungry. I'll get some breakfast in a bit and have a nap."
"You'll rest," Navaris said.
I promise you that. You won't be hungry either.
Two, called Nalus.
I'm curious, Tavi said. How did you survive the sinking of the Mactus?
Araris killed his witch man. You only gutted yours. We got him into a boat and he hid us from the Leviathans.
Three, called Nalus.
Her lips spread into a soulless smile.
It took him 3 days to die. Time enough to get us clear of the run.
Tavi felt a surge of nausea at the description. 3 days. Crows, that was a bad way to go. Though he supposed there weren't many good ones.
I've been looking forward to this, Navaris said.
Four!
Why's that? Tavi asked.
Because you're the bait, boy.
Her eyes left his for a moment, focusing down the length of the wall behind him.
Once you're dead, Valerian there will come for me.
She shuddered.
And that will be a fight worth watching.
Five!
You have to get there first, Tavi said. Navaris tilted her head, her eyes returning to his.
Six!
I'm curious, she said. Are you truly Princeps Octavian?
Tavi gave her a copy of her little smile. We'll know shortly.
Seven!
Nalus called. Navaris's breathing began to speed up. He watched her eyes dilate, and a series of eager little shivers ran through her body and down the length of both of her blades. His mouth felt dry, but he focused on what Araris had told him. Patience. Control. He faced the cutter and touched lightly on the steel of his blade with his crafting, drawing his world into sharp, calm focus.
Eight!
Navaris's lips parted, and her body undulated strangely, as if it wished to fly straight into battle without consulting her feet.
Nine!
Tavi took a deep breath. Kitai's voice rang out clear and vibrant in the silence between Nalus's counts, ringing from the stones so that every man, woman, and child looking on was sure to hear it.
Take her to the crows, Aleran!
Ten!
The first Aleran spoke in a single enormous deafening voice that shook the stones as the legion roared its encouragement for their commander. Phrygia Navaris's eyes glittered with sudden lust and fury, and her mouth opened in a wordless cry of something eerily like pleasure as she lifted her blades and darted at Tavi. Chapter 55. Navaris was fast. She closed the distance in the blink of an eye, both weapons whirling out in front of her, weaving through a rapid series of slashes broken by the occasional lightning thrust. Before the first Alaran's roar had died down, she had sent 50 strokes toward Tavi, and he was certain that only steady retreat and his recent intensive training with Araris enabled him to stop them. Colored sparks showered out every time the blades met, and the cuts and parries came so swiftly that Tavi could hardly see through them. He felt as if they were fighting in a blizzard of miniature stars. Her assault was unrelenting, aggressive, and precise. Her cuts and slashes slammed hard into his upraised weapons so that he felt the shock all the way to his shoulder when they hit. They were by far the simplest attacks to defeat. Her thrusts slithered forward like double-bladed serpents, smooth, almost unpredictable, and impossibly fast. He caught each one as it came in, but only responded with the most conservative of counter-attacks, more meant to force her to remain wary of a counter-strike than actually to draw blood. He missed the next thrust and had to spin to the side, arching his back out. Navaris's sword struck a line of sparks along his belly, glancing off the Lyrica, and leaving a seared black crease on the legion's steel. If she could strike squarely against his armor, her sword would pierce it like cloth. Twice Tavi saw an obvious opening, but Araris had taught him better than that. It had been a deliberate act on Navaris's part, and had Tavi launched his own attack in unthinking response, he would have paid with his life. And then Tavi felt it. A flicker of surprise and concern that flowed from Navaris, colouring the riot of emotions that spilled from her. She stepped up the pace and power of her attacks, but not enough to allow Tavi his chance to strike. He was forced to backpedal more quickly, and his defense wavered for a moment before solidifying under the storm of steel and light that threatened to engulf him.
Footwork!
Araris cried. Tavi didn't dare glance down at his feet. The cutter would skewer him. But he felt his balance shift for a second, and realized that Navaris had driven him back to the edge of the wall. His right heel was hanging over empty air. Navaris surged forward again, and Tavi knew that if he didn't have room to retreat, he'd never hold off her furious assault. He called upon the wind and turned the whole world into a hazy, languidly fluid portrait. His blades swept up, simultaneously sliding aside, one thrust aimed at his throat, the other at his groin. Even as he felt the contact, he drew power up through the heavy stone of the wall, pivoted, and flung himself into empty air. The fury-born strength of his legs sent him sailing across a 20-foot volume of open space to land on the rooftop of the nearest building. He landed heavily. There was generally no other way to land when one wore heavy armor, and rolled as the overstrained stonework of the roof gave way in his wake, falling straight down into the dilapidated building beneath him. He gained his feet as the watching crowd erupted into cheers. Navarra stared coldly at Tavi for a moment, then down at the wall. With a quick practical motion, she reversed her grip on her gladius, knelt, and with a single thrust drove it several inches into the stone of the vertical surface of the wall's interior. Then she backed away, long blade in her right hand, took two bounding steps forward and leapt. Her heels came down upon the quillions of the blade embedded in the wall. The gladius bent, then flexed back with unnatural strength, flinging the cutter into the air. She turned a complete flip as she sailed toward Tavi and landed in a roll on the building's roof, exactly as he had. Except, he realized with a sinking feeling, that the roof hadn't collapsed under the slender, lightly armored woman's weight. His situation had not improved. At least on the wall he had known where the drop was. If he spent much time shuffling around up here, he was sure to find a weak spot and fall right through the roof, and almost certainly through the rotted wooden floors of the building's interior. Navaris drew a dagger from her belt and stalked forward. She smirked, and Tavi felt certain that she had come to the same conclusions he had about the roof. They engaged again, and storms of blazing motes shattered from every touch of blade on blade. Though Navaris's offensive potential had been reduced by the loss of her gladius, Tavi, forced to keep track of his footing, could not take advantage of it. Bits of rubble threatened to turn beneath his feet, and the fury lamps on the wall were just far enough away to offer deep shadows that concealed the sections of rooftop that had already fallen. Tavi's instinct screamed at him to take the offensive and drive the fight off the rooftop, but he knew it would be a deadly mistake. "Patience," Araris had said. "Wait for the opening." But Navaris hadn't given him one. Tavi barely avoided a neatly executed maneuver that would have disarmed him and whipped his shorter blade at Navaris's dagger arm. The blade struck. Navaris's attack stopped at once, and the two stood poised, barely out of one another's reach, weapons raised. The stillness was eerie, broken only by Tavi's steady, heavy breaths and those of his opponent. A tiny trickle of blood wound its way down Navaris's hand. "You pinked me," she said, her head tilted, her eyes narrowed with what felt to Tavi like a sudden and somewhat alarming interest. "That hasn't happened in years." Tavi didn't move, holding his gladius at arm's length in his left hand, in a low guard, his long blade in his right slightly forward, pommel close to his body, tip aimed at Navaris's throat. Any shifting of his weight or stance would give her an opening for a blow he might not be able to repel. But by the same token, she couldn't move without facing a similar risk. The hit had been the result of luck as much as skill, but it had certainly caught Navaris's attention. She would be more wary now, harder to strike, and there would be no repetition of his riposte's success. Tavi gritted his teeth. He had to push her somehow, get her to take more chances, come at him even harder. Otherwise he would wind up one more name on the list of people killed by Phrygia Navaris. But how? There was nothing for him to work with. The woman was apparently driven solely by a desire to inflict pain on others, coupled with an obsessive need to prove her skill. If he used his earthcraft to increase his strength, he was likely to leave her an opening while he demonstrated the danger to her.
If he wind-crafted greater alacrity into his attacks, it was entirely possible that she'd skewer him before he had the chance to frighten her. Speed alone was no guarantor of success. But how else to force her into a more aggressive attack without getting himself killed in the process? Outthink her. Create the opening. Blades and furies aren't dangerous. Minds and wills are dangerous. There was another way to overcome her skill and metal craft, by overturning the mind and will that sustained the cautious discipline that could prove lethal to Tavi. In the face of that discipline and skill, he would never be able to take her down blade to blade. Not all weapons were made of steel. His mother had shown him that. Tavi suppressed a surge of excitement and focused on his watercraft, the emotions of the mad cutter, and he had no doubt at all now that she was completely insane. Washed over him in a fluttering tangle of sensation, it blended weirdly with his sense of the weapons in her hands. "Phrygia Navaris," Tavi said quietly, keeping his eyes on the center of her mass. Arm and hand motions could deceive, but real movement would always show in her center of balance. She stared at him. Any number of things could have caused the woman's madness and obsession, but some were still more likely than others. The deepest joys and most terrible wounds were both to be had from family. The name Phrygia, like every other metronym in the realm, was an indicator of illegitimacy. Children who were not recognized by their fathers and admitted into their houses legally became members of the city house of whichever high lord held authority over their birthplace. That was why Max went by Antilla. His father, High Lord Antillus, had never legally recognized him, never accepted him. It was fair to say that Max had been driven to a few extreme behaviors, largely in reaction to that fundamental insecurity, the old wound in his soul. Tavi himself knew what it was like to grow up without a father. The absence had left an enormous hole in him, one that never seemed to completely fill again. And when something touched it, it was agony. Oh, yes. If he was right, he could hurt Navaris. He could kill her with a breath. "You can't win this fight," Tavi said quietly. "If you beat me, these walls will be overrun with Khanim. Everyone will die." "Probably," she replied, her voice entirely too calm. "But I'll take Araris first."
"Even if it kills you?"
"Yes."
"Why? What's the point?"
"To prove that I am the best," Navaris said. "The greatest blade Alera has ever known."
Tavi forced himself not to sound eager as he replied. "Prove to whom?" Tavi asked quietly. Navaris did not answer. Pain mixed with the other emotions flooding from her.
"I grew up without a father too," Tavi said.
Navaris stared. The miasma of her diseased spirit and mind thickened on the word father. Tavi had been right. He knew how much the slightest touch upon that old heartache could send him into a rage if he was not careful to contain it. Navaris bore a similar wound, but unlike Tavi, the cyclone of fury and hate that roared through her was barely under control on the best of days. True, her will was harder than diamonds, but Tavi was about to hit it at precisely the right angle. The fight was over. She just didn't realize it yet.
"You aren't going to prove anything to your father, you know," Tavi said. "Even if you defeat Araris and me, you'll die here. The story of what happened will die here."
The tip of Navaris's long blade trembled.
"He didn't want you, Navaris. Do you think a mound of corpses will make him seek reconciliation? Do you think he'd run to wrap his loving arms around a bloodthirsty murderess?"
Navaris's eyes widened until Tavi could see the whites all the way around them, and she gnashed her teeth as an even greater wave of agony ran through her. The cutter's voice shook.
"Stop it!"
"He won't," Tavi said, pitiless and precise. "He never will. You've become a monster, and you'd bring nothing but shame to his house. Just as you bring nothing but suffering to the world." The cutter began to shake her head slowly, and her wide, mad eyes suddenly glistened. The woman was in pain. Old, old pain, the pain of a wounded child who couldn't understand why it was happening or how to recover from it. Tavi knew it. He'd known it all his life, and it suddenly became difficult to tell where Navarus's torments stopped and his own began. The woman's pain fed upon itself, and Tavi felt his stomach turn with involuntary sympathy, but he forced himself to continue. "It doesn't matter how many you kill or whom you kill. You'll never be welcome." She started taking heavy, labored breaths, though neither one of them had moved. "Your entire life has been a lie. You are a lie, Navarus." He lowered his voice and said gently, "You're nothing to him. You are nothing, Navarus. Nothing but a mad, miserable animal who's got to be put down." She let out a guttural moan through her open mouth, and the childlike grief suddenly fused with the berserk intensity of her hostility and rage, her self-control shattering into chips and shards. Something strange happened. Tavi, his crafting senses, both water and metal, focused simultaneously and more intently than ever before, felt the next stroke coming before the center of Navarus's body ever moved, as if her physical intentions had somehow been transmitted to him through her emotions. Tavi could not say what had changed precisely, but he knew, he absolutely knew, that she was about to fling the dagger at his face and follow up with her sword in the instant of distraction it afforded her. Tavi called upon the wind and watched as Navarus's arm slowly rose and flicked forward. The dagger flickered end over end, but Tavi had already raised his gladius and cut the dagger from the air. Navarus's throat erupted in a howl of feral rage as she came forward, a lightning slash aimed for his throat. It was the opening Tavi had been waiting for. He'd practiced it so many times that he had no need to think about it, his body moving with automatic precision. As Navarus surged forward, Tavi let his weight drop, falling under her blade, his body angled on a diagonal to Navarus's line of attack. As his left hand hit the ground, he extended his right arm back along his side, then snapped it forward in a single deadly thrust. His sword sank through her armor and body with effortless ease. Navarus gasped, her tearing eyes widening. Tavi felt the motion of the exhalation travel up the blade to his hand. She turned her eyes to him and swept her sword at him, but Tavi released the hilt of his long blade, leaving it buried in her body, and rolled away from the attack. He came to his feet at once, shifted the gladius to his right hand, and stood ready. Phrygia Navarus took one step toward him, then another. She bared her teeth in a grimace of madness and hate, lifted her sword, and sank down like an emptied flagon. She lay on her side for a moment, eyes staring, and her arms and legs made fitful twitching motions as though she believed that she was still fighting. Then she went still. Tavi felt the rage and pain and grief and terror continue to pour from her. In a few seconds it died down to a trickle. Then it stopped. Tavi stared down at the cutter's corpse. Then he knelt and gently closed her empty, staring eyes. He couldn't remember ever feeling so weary, but his work wasn't done. Tavi heaved himself to his feet and closed his eyes. He lifted his head to the stars and let the breeze blow the perspiration from his skin. The wind blew, and silence ruled the night. Chapter 56. Marcus did not find it difficult to reach his shooting position unseen. There were grass and brush and trees enough to provide him with a frail, wood-crafted veil, and shadows enough to cover what his crafting did not. Over the past 2 weeks he'd managed to slip out of camp at night to practice with the Carnim Ballist, and found the weapon accurate enough for his purposes. Once he'd reached his position, he took a pair of clay jars from a belt pouch. He opened each one, careful to keep his nose and mouth well away from them, and took a single heavy steel bolt from the pouch. He dipped the tip of the bolt into each jar, then waved a hand, calling upon his earth fury, and the two jars and their lids sank gently down into the ground. He set the bolt aside. Then he summoned up strength enough to haul the ballast into its prepared position. It was an enormous strain, even with his fury-born strength, and he had to be cautious, move slowly, so that he wouldn't slip or lose his grip on the weapon, betraying his position as the bow stave snapped straight again. Once that was done, he slid the poisoned bolt into its groove in the ballast and hefted the weapon. Silence reigned, the air thick with anticipation. The duel was over. Marcus lifted the weapon silently, his arms steady, and waited for the winner to appear. Chapter 57. Isana told herself that she would not go to the duel when there were still so many wounded to tend to. She threw herself into the work, sending her senses with Rill through each wounded body. A man named Foss, the officer in charge of the healer's corps, watched her with the first man he brought over, nodded his head, and promptly started barking orders. Isana shortly found herself tending to men with the most dire and delicate of injuries. One poor soul's eyes had been viciously slashed by some weapon. Another young man had suffered what looked like a spear thrust through the genitals. A third had been treated for a cracked sternum, but hadn't regained consciousness. His first healer hadn't felt the bruising on his heart that made it labor unsteadily and insufficiently. Isana poured herself into her efforts, and at a steady pace restored each man to health and exhausted sleep. She didn't know how many men she worked on, but between efforts she dimly realized that she should have pushed herself to exhaustion after only a handful. She felt tired, of course, but the work seemed easier, swifter, as if her touch had become a dozen times more sensitive, allowing her to pinpoint precisely where the damage was, then to direct her fury's healing power with more precision and grace. Her talents had not grown so much as she was taxing herself less to do the same amount of work.
"Last one," grunted an orderly, lowering another battered young body into the healing tub Isana was using. He was a young man, large and well-muscled, and his legs, belly, and chest were covered in savage burns.
Isana winced, and was grateful that the poor legionare was unconscious. Burns like that would have left any conscious mind blind with agony. And if her ability to help the wounded had grown, their suffering had been that much more difficult to bear. The legionare settled into the tub, and Isana supported his head, making sure he didn't slip under the water, and was startled to realize that she recognized the man. It was Tavi's friend, Max. She closed her eyes and went to work with steady, determined patience. Burns were some of the worst wounds to heal, she would have said the worst, until she had spent weeks in nearly constant crafting, dealing with an infection brought on by rancid garlic oil introduced into a wound. Though burns were not that festering nightmare, they were bad enough, and the drain upon the wounded Max would be tremendous, even dangerous. She turned her attention to the maimed flesh, and with Rill's help, got things sorted out. She reduced the damage as much as she could, to the point where she believed it would leave no hideous scarring, but felt the young man's strength waning and dared not press for more. She leaned back from her efforts and nodded wearily to the orderly. She sat back as Max was taken to a bed and dried her hands on a towel.
"My lady," said a voice behind her. "If you ever want a job, I can offer you the rank of senior sub-tribune and start you at the maximum pay grade."
Isana turned to find Foss watching them carry Max off and shaking his head.
"Crows," the legion healer said. "In a rational world, you'd get my job."
She smiled wearily at him. "Thank you, Tribune. I'm sure you could have done as much." Foss snorted.
"You gave a man back his eyes, my lady. That's fine work, and I've known maybe two or three healers in my life who could do that, and one of them was a high lady. You did more work than any three of my healers, and in half the time. You have a remarkable gift."
He bowed his head to her.
"Thank you."
She blinked at him several times and felt somewhat flustered.
"You're quite welcome."
Foss nodded and offered her his hand.
"We'd better get moving. It's almost time."
"Time?" Isana asked.
"The trial, my lady."
Isana frowned and shivered. As she worked, she'd all but forgotten the duel.
Perhaps she'd been hoping that it would be over by the time she'd emerged from all the crafting. If so, she thought, then she had been wrong to think it. Her son was about to fight for his life, for all of their lives, and she should be there. The duel was the most elated, ecstatic nightmare she had ever experienced. The crowd's emotion was a violent sea, a seething cauldron. If she hadn't worked herself to near exhaustion, she would have run screaming for the nearest dark hole, which would have looked rather unladylike, all things considered. As it stood, a bodyguard of 8 legionaries waited outside the healer's tent, evidently assigned as her escort. Each of the men was rather young, though they all had the hardened look of men accustomed to war, and the breast of their armor was decorated not with the red and blue eagle of the crown, but with a similarly depicted black crow. The crowd parted for her as she approached, and she felt them all around her, people buzzing with excitement and hope, with despair and fear, and with interest. For her, specifically. Faces turned toward her, and voices were raised in excitement. Legionaries and trapped camp followers alike pressed closer, trying to see her, and to her intense embarrassment, the crowd actually sent up a cheer. The solid forms of her guards gently kept the onlookers from getting too close, but a slender figure slid between the two in front, and Aaron smiled at her. "My lady," he said, bowing his head as he went to her side. "My goodness," Isana said, looking around her uncertainly. "Aaron, they know," he said. "Everyone in the camp knows, my lady, since all the truth-finders took testimony. No story that juicy was going to stay secret for long."
"I see," she said.
"Tavi," Aaron caught himself and shook his head. "Octavian asked me to stand with you."
"I'd be glad of your company," Isana said quietly.
She kept walking, as more people gathered around, staring at her in the dim light of both torches and small household fury lamps.
"This is a very strange experience."
"I can imagine," Aaron said. "But if things go well, this is nothing compared to what you'll see in the streets of Alera Imperia some day."
"Oh dear," Isana said.
They took her to a small open area directly before the wall where the duel was to take place. There was quiet talk all around her, but she paid little attention to it. She focused only upon the two men who began climbing a ladder. The next few moments passed in eerie silence as the taller of the two men began to limber up, stretching. The tension of the crowd rose steadily until Isana felt sure that if she suddenly dropped unconscious it would hold her upright where she stood. Then her son followed Nalus out onto the wall and faced the slender woman who had nearly killed them only hours before. There was brief talk. There was counting. Kitai's voice rang out in sudden scorn and defiance, and the gathered crowd roared its fear and tension and expectation into the cool night air. The two combatants came together, and Isana had never seen anything so bright and beautiful and terrifying. Tavi's weapons erupted in scarlet and azure sparks, while flashes of brilliant bilious green showered from Navarus's blades. The light was blindingly bright, and every flash left a spot of color burned onto Isana's vision. She had never seen anyone move so swiftly as Phrygia Navarus, and she could hardly believe that her son could withstand such speed and fury. They fought in constant, graceful motion, dance-like and deadly, four blades spinning and whirling and thrusting, and the ring of steel on steel with its accompanying flash of light grew swifter and swifter. She could only stare, terrified and fascinated, and if the steadily thickening silence from the crowd was any indication, they felt the same way. Navarus nearly drove Tavi from the wall, and her heart caught in her throat. Then she saw him turn, somehow impossibly slipping aside from Navarus's blade, and bound through the air like a hunting cat, leaping several yards to land on the roof of another building. Navarus followed him over, and then the pair of them were out of sight of the crowd below. Steel chimed on steel as swiftly as a drum roll, echoing strangely through the ruins. Spectral light flashed through the air, casting stillborn shadows, gone as quickly as they appeared.
Stones clattered to the ground, all dull cracking sounds and heavy thumps of impact. Isana couldn't breathe. She became vaguely aware of a sharp pain in her hands, and idly thought that her nails had begun biting into her own flesh. The crowd's growing tension and excitement felt as though it could have drawn blood as well. She stared at the roof, hoping, willing it to be over. The swords stopped ringing. The lights stopped flashing. Isana heard herself moan in her throat. Silence stretched on and on. Then there was an enraged scream, a sound so raw, so full of madness and rage that she could hardly believe it had come from a human throat. Light flashed but once more. Silence fell.
"Tavi,"
Isana heard herself whisper.
"Oh, my Tavi."
The crowd remained perfectly still, as motionless as the stones of the ruins around them, and even more silent. It was unbearable to Isana, that tension, and she found herself rocking forward and back where she stood, fighting against the tears that blurred her vision.
"Tavi,"
she whispered. And then Marat war cries filled the air. The barbarians sent up a joyous howling upon their rooftop. The wild, fierce cries of their people danced among the stones. Isana stared, stunned, her mind only sluggishly processing the meaning behind the sounds. Tavi. They were cheering for Tavi. Her son appeared at the edge of the rooftop, and the ruined city went wild. Alarans cried out in a great roar. Legionaries began slamming their fists to their chests in rhythmic thunder. Somewhere in the ruins, horses screamed out shrill cries of challenge. Dogs kept by the camp followers set up a howling chorus of their own. Legion drummers pounded on their instruments in glee, and legion trumpeters sounded their horns. The noise was so loud that a section of ruined wall not far from Isana trembled and collapsed. A burning cyclone of elation enveloped Isana and threatened to rip the consciousness from her mind. She closed her eyes against it, and only Aaron's support kept her from falling to her knees. The fire was too hot. It had to be turned aside, channeled away from her before she went mad. She opened her eyes and forced herself to stand straight. "Hail!" she cried. "Hail, Gaius Octavian!" Aaron gave her a glance, then took up the cry as well. "Hail, Gaius Octavian!" The legionaries formed up around her were next.
"Hail, Gaius Octavian!"
It spread rapidly from there, from ruin to ruin, century to century, street to debris-choked street.
"Hail, Gaius Octavian! Hail, Gaius Octavian! Hail, Gaius Octavian!"
Chapter 58. The crow-begotten crowd kept on screaming his name, and Tavi wanted to tear his hair out in pure frustration. Arnos was getting away. The senator had vanished from his spot on the wall, and Tavi spotted him heading into the crowd, lifting the hood of his practical brown cape. That explained why he'd worn the simple travelling clothes instead of the expensive robes, then. Tavi pointed at him and shouted at his men to pursue Arnos, and the roar of the crowd grew louder. No one set off in pursuit, though, and Arnos was headed into the thickest part of the crowd. Tavi turned to Kitai and screamed her name. There was no way she could have heard his call, not over the furor of the crowd, but her head snapped around toward him, her features set in concern. Tavi flashed her hand signs for enemy and fleeing and pursue, then he pointed at Arnos. Kitai's eyes widened and she turned her head, following the line indicated by Tavi's finger. Her eyes narrowed and she shouted into the ears of the Marat near her. The barbarians rose and began bounding from one roof and ruined wall to the next, lithe and agile as hunting cats. One of them landed in the circle of space the detachment of the battle crows had cleared for his mother and shouted something to Aaron. Then he rushed into the crowd. Tavi signaled him with stay and defend and trusted him to work out that he was to stay with Isana. Aaron nodded and signed back, "Understood," which happened to be a motion very like a legion salute, and stepped closer to Isana, who looked distracted and preoccupied. Little wonder. Even up on the roof, the storm of emotion in the crowd below was grating against Tavi's senses. His mother must have been half unconscious from it. Tavi turned and looked at the wall where Araris waited. He'd never actually made a leap of that distance before tonight, and his ability to jump so far had been strictly theoretical until he'd actually done it. He wondered if he'd be able to do it without a murderous maniac at his back to encourage him. No help for it. He'd never get through the still-roaring crowd on the ground. So he focused on his intentions, drew strength from the stone beneath him, speed from the night breeze, and hurtled back across the same space to the battlements. He'd leapt too hard, and he slammed into a massive stone merlin before he could stop himself. His armor soaked up much of the impact, and he pushed away from the stone as Araris came to his side.
"Arnos!"
Tavi wheezed. Araris nodded once, his eyes intent on the crowd below.
"I see him."
"Go!"
Tavi said. Araris broke into a run, moving down the battlements, and Tavi followed him, peering down at the crowd until he saw the brown-cloaked, hooded figure roughly pushing his way through them, heading for the far side of the ruined city. Then Arnos stopped in his tracks and began backpedaling. Tavi looked past him and saw a pair of Marat crouched on a wall ahead of Arnos, their dyed manes blowing in the wind.
"Here," Tavi said.
He turned to another ladder mounted on the wall, took a few rungs normally, then clamped his boots to the outside of the ladder and slid rapidly down it until he hit the ground. He turned and hadn't gone two steps before Araris hit the ground behind him. The Singulare sprinted past Tavi, drew his sword and ran forward, striking at the stones of the ground as he went. Each strike sent out a shower of sparks, a flash of light, and Araris bellowed,
"Make way!"
as he went. The crowd parted before him. Tavi moved forward, taking his cue from the Marat, who had formed a slowly tightening ring around Arnos in a classic hunting technique. None of them, he noted, were actually attempting to apprehend the senator. The Marat had a strong sense of the appropriate. Arnos was Tavi's enemy foremost. Barring any practical considerations that might alter the situation, they would leave it to Tavi to deal with him. Tavi caught up with Arnos as the panting senator shoved through a group of camp followers, knocking an old peddler over, and seized a woman by the arms. He shook her, snarling something at her Tavi could not make out over the noise.
"Guntus Arnos!" Tavi bellowed.
Arnos's head snapped around. He bared his teeth, his eyes desperate, and hauled the woman around, putting her body between his own and Tavi's, holding her by the hair. He drew a dagger in his other hand and held it to the woman's throat.
"This wasn't the plan!" Arnos shouted.
Araris took a few steps to the left and Tavi to the right. Tavi had drawn his sword again at some point. He realized, with a little shock of recognition, that the woman was the first spear's companion. The noise of the legionaries and civilians around them became confused and began to dwindle.
"It's over, Arnos!" Tavi said. "Put the knife down."
"I won't," Arnos spat.
"I won't. It isn't going to end like this."
"Yes," Tavi replied. "It is. Let the woman go."
"Madness,"
Arnos cried, shaking the woman's head through his grip on her hair.
"Madness. You can't let this go on. You can..."
Suddenly, both Arnos and the woman jerked, and the steel head of a Carnim Balest bolt erupted from her chest. The woman's face went white, and her eyes rolled back in her head. Her knees gave way, and she melted slowly to the ground, her arms spread to her sides, her open mouth to the sky. Arnos stood in place behind her, and the dagger fell from his fingers. He looked down at the blood flooding from the hole in his chest, where the bolt that had spitted them both emerged. He screamed, a sound full of protest and terror. It was a breathless scream, one with no strength, and his hands scrabbled at his chest, as if he thought he could brush the wound away if only he acted quickly enough. Tavi walked over to him, Araris at his back. Arnos was letting out desperate little grunting coughs, and blood bubbled from his lips as he did. His hands kept moving, but his fingers seemed to have gone limp,
and he was only slapping uselessly at his life-blood as it spilled from the massive wound the Khanim projectile had left in his chest. Tavi flashed signals to the Marat. Archer, that way. Find. The barbarians loped into the ruins, eyes bright. Their night vision would give the unseen assassin nowhere to hide.
Healer! Tavi bellowed. Now!
Onos turned a look of pathetic gratitude on Tavi, reaching out with his useless hands to grasp at the young man. Tavi slapped Onos's hands away with one motion and dealt him a contemptuous blow to the face with the back of his hand with the next. Onos fell to the ground and landed on his side, shaking his head. He tried to speak, but blood strangled whatever he'd been going to say.
For the woman, not for you.
Tavi squatted next to Onos and said,
I'm doing you a kindness you probably don't deserve, Senator. This is a better death than the Khanim would give you.
Onos's head jerked and his eyes went out of focus. He made a few thrashing movements, his expression twisting, knotting, becoming absolutely agonized. Tavi didn't want to feel the man's terror and pain and confusion, but he still did. Logically, his actions had merited far more than what he had received, but he was still human, still Tavi's countryman, and someone who, in a perfect world, Tavi would have protected from his own ambition. Onos died there in a pool of his own blood, frightened and friendless and broken. Tavi wouldn't lose any time mourning the fool, but he regretted the needless deaths of so many Alarans, even the senators. Things like that shouldn't happen to anyone. Tavi pulled Onos's cloak over his face and head and asked Araris,
How is she?
Not good, Araris said. He'd torn off his cape, folded it into a pad, and had it pressed hard against her back.
Pulse is thready. I think she's got a hole in her lung and she might be bleeding into it. We don't dare move her and...
Araris froze for a second, then leaned forward, his nostrils flared.
What is it? I think this bolt was poisoned.
Tavi leaned down and sniffed himself. There was a faintly corrupt odor from the wound in the front of the domestic's body, underlying a sharper, almost lemony scent.
That's heart fire, he said. Master Killian taught us to recognize it. It speeds up the victim's heart until it bursts. Blinds them, too. I don't know what the other scent is.
Rancid garlic oil, Araris said.
I've only read about that.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
Crows,
Tavi said.
She's the first spears woman.
Araris shook his head.
Bad bloody luck.
This way, called Kitai from behind them. A moment later she arrived, leading a score of Marat and a trio of weary-looking healers, including Tribune Foss. The bearish tribune immediately examined the wound and listened as Tavi explained about the poison. Then he and the other healers loaded the woman onto a stretcher as gently as they could and carried her away, while the Marat took position around Tavi. Tavi watched them go and rubbed at his forehead with one hand.
Get me two horses. Tie the late senator over one of them.
You can't ride out to the Khanim, Araris said. They aren't dealing in good faith. Look what they just did to Onos.
Tavi shook his head and rose. He held out one hand and said,
Onos was about this tall.
Yes, Araris said.
And the woman was bent back with the top of her head level with his.
Yes.
Onos's wound was in the center of his chest. Hers was in the same spot, but more to the right because of where she was standing. Tavi extended a finger in a straight line. The bolt was traveling horizontally and fast enough to pierce them both, which means it was fired from fairly short range, from inside the walls. Araris followed the line of reasoning.
You don't think the Khanim did this?
Kitai came to stand beside Tavi. He thinks Alarans are far more capable than the Khanim are when it comes to treachery and backshooting, she said quietly. He's right. Tavi found her warm hand with his and squeezed tight. She returned it, gripping hard.
"Which leaves us with a question for which we have no answer," Tavi said.
Araris nodded. "If not the Khanim," he murmured, "then who did it?"
Chapter 59. Valiar Marcus stood upon the southern battlements with his men, watching as the princeps rode forth from the ruins. A second horse, trailing on a rope, carried Senator Arnas's corpse draped upon its back. The sun was rising, the lands around them steadily growing brighter. The Baelis had gone the same way as the jars of poison. It had been tricky for a few moments when the Marat had come looking for the hidden archer, but his woodcrafted veil had served him well, and he eluded them. The whole thing had gone to the crows, as such plans often did. Marcus had been forced to change position when the senator bolted. He'd been sure the man would run to Lady Aquitaine, given a chance, but he'd fled even before the duel was over, and Marcus had been forced to shadow him. Fortunately, it had hardly been difficult to remain unobserved in the frenzy around the duel, and he'd been able to use the reactions of the hunting Marat as a guide to the senator. The doubled opportunity he'd finally found had been a stroke of good fortune he had acted upon instinctively and instantly. Such moments could not be predicted, and never lasted. The tiniest hesitation, and they were gone. He had heard that Davia, courier legion domestic, had died in the healing tub, as the poison on the bolt set her heart to racing, spreading the deadly taint of the garrick oil through the whole of her body until her life had simply failed. That was a pity, Marcus thought. The woman was undeniably capable. She could have been a tremendous asset to the realm, handled properly, and the loss of such potential to the crown was regrettable. On the other hand, she was stubborn. He doubted she would have cooperated quickly or easily. He was certain he would not have survived the fallout, regardless of what she chose to do. Still, the skills of the powerful bloodlines of Alera were vital to the long-term survival of the realm, and he felt himself smile a little. For a moment there, he'd been thinking like a cursor.
"What do you think, First Spear?" asked Tribune Kellis.
The annoying young officer had survived the battle and had naturally wandered away from his command again to come chew the fat with Marcus.
"Sir?" Marcus asked politely.
Kellis nodded at the Khanim army outside, surrounding the ruins.
"Think the captain can get us out of this?"
"Difficult to say, sir," Marcus replied.
"I hope so," Kellis muttered. Marcus drew in a breath and silently counted to three.
"Yes, sir."
The princeps stopped as a group of Khanim, with what must have been two or three former Alaran slaves, came out of the enemy ranks to meet him. They faced off about 10 feet from one another. Then two of the slaves, an armoured legionare and a black-haired woman in a grey dress, came forward to examine the body. The woman looked at his face and nodded, and then the enemy contingent withdrew, except for a single Khane, an enormous, scarred, black-furred brute, who remained facing the princeps. The princeps dismounted and walked up to face the Khane, who towered over him by a good 3 feet. The Khane drew a heavy sword from his belt. The princeps mirrored him. The Khane reversed his grip on the weapon. The princeps did the same. Then, moving slowly, almost ritually, they exchanged weapons and stepped away from one another. The Khane slipped the Legion Gladius through his belt as a man might a dagger. The princeps had to slide the massive Khanim weapon through a loop attached to his horse's saddle. The princeps mounted, and the two faced one another for a moment, probably talking. Then the princeps tilted his head slightly to one side. The Khane casually lifted one fist to its chest in an Alaran salute and tilted its head more deeply to one side. Then he turned and strode away. Horns blared, and within a minute the Khanim army was on the move. And they followed the enormous Khane back to Mastings, away from the ruins on the hilltop. Legionaries stared. And then as the princeps rode back to the walls, still bearing Arnas's body, the entire hilltop erupted into cheering, the blowing of horns, the beating of drums.
"He did it!" Kellis shouted, pounding on Marcus's back. "Bloody crows and great furies, he did it!"
Marcus endured the buffeting without complaining or knocking a few teeth from the young officer's mouth, but just barely.
"Yes, sir," he agreed. "He seems to have formed a habit."
The jubilation continued as the princeps rode back up the hill, and Marcus excused himself, leaving his senior centurion in charge of the cohort. He didn't have much time. The princeps would call for a council immediately. Marcus made his way to the healers' tents and found most of them asleep, simply stretched out on the ground, too exhausted to walk back to their bedrolls. He looked around until he found Foss and shook the tribune's shoulder.
"I should kill you," Foss said blearily.
He opened his eyes, blinked them a few times, and said, "Oh, Marcus."
"I'd like to see her," Marcus said quietly. "Her?" Foss mumbled.
Then he winced and said,
"Oh, right. I'm sorry, Marcus. We did everything we could for her, but it happens," he replied wearily. "I just want to say goodbye." "Sure," Foss said, his usual gruff tone gentle.
He jerked his head at some hanging curtains at the rear of the tent.
"Back there."
Marcus made his way back to the curtains and parted them. Six bodies lay behind them, covered in bloody shrouds. He began lifting shrouds, revealing dead, pale faces with grey lips. Five were fallen legionaries. One was an elderly woman. None of them was Lady Aquitaine. Marcus's blood ran cold. He strode back out to Foss, cuffed the man's shoulder to wake him up, and said, "Where?"
"Back there," Foss protested, waving at the curtains. "She was the last we worked on. She's right back there." "No," Marcus snarled. "She isn't."
Foss blinked at him. Then he rose, groaning, and shambled back to look for himself.
"Huh," he said after looking around. "I don't understand it. She was right there."
He nodded at an empty space at the end of the row of bodies.
"Seven of them. Now there are six," Marcus said.
"Seven minus one, yeah," Foss said testily.
"Look, we've been asleep for a while, Marcus. Sometimes family or friends come for domestics or followers who are killed rather than sending them to a mass legion grave. You know that."
Marcus shook his head. The surge of fear had faded rather rapidly as his exhaustion finally caught up with him. He knew he should be stealing a fast horse and running for his life, but he was just too tired. Besides, he'd do it again in a heartbeat, and he was finished with running. He exchanged a few more words with Foss, and then marched out of the healer's tent and toward the command tent. In the end, what difference did it make if he died for this choice, or one of the many others that could come back to haunt him? As long as he was still alive, there was a job to do, a realm to defend, and a captain to serve. Chapter 60. All in all, Tarvi supposed, it could have been worse. It took him another 3 hours to gather up the surviving commanders of the three legions, hash out exactly what resources were left to them, and get them positioned where he wanted them to be. He set up the watch, arranged for water to be carted in from the wells that hadn't been poisoned, and ordered everyone who wasn't engaged in one of those two tasks to get some sleep. He suspected it was that last order, more than any of the others, that won him the approval of the officers of the Senatorial Guard. Then they buried the dead, honoring the fallen, and the first spear called the roll for the entire legion, marking the names of the dead on his lists, in half a day of quiet tribute. The wake that night was subdued. There was little alcohol to be had, and too many of their brothers were missing to allow sober legionaries to forget that lack. For the most part, the camp turned in early. The next 2 days were a mess, adjusting the formations of the battered legions, caring for the wounded, and setting up a proper camp. The first Alaren had taken a terrible beating, almost as bad as at the Battle of the Elenarch. Even so, they were in better shape than either of the Senatorial Guard legions, even though they'd both come in marching heavily over strength. The captain of the first Senatorial had been killed in the fighting, and the next most senior officer was the tribune Auxiliarus, whose cavalry had been responsible for the attacks on several steadholts.
The man hadn't returned from his most recent patrol, or if he had, he'd somehow learned which way the wind was blowing and elected not to remain. None of the officers below him seemed willing to risk his possible wrath by taking the command that was rightfully his.